Hi everyone, you're listening to the Bialucci Podcast, uncensored and completely unedited discussions about life and everything in it. We hope you enjoy the show.
And we're back.
Hello.
In tropical London.
Yes, the summer of, the glorious summer of 2023.
Do you reckon we get away with opening the windows?
No, not in the middle of Soho.
No?
No.
Oh, okay.
There's already people running around screaming.
Yeah. It's Soho. It's the vibrance of London.
Oh, keep close to that mic.
Yeah, okay, sure.
No, oh, I saw that film the other day. Soho.
Last Night in Soho.
Yeah. What's your thoughts before I slate it?
Well, it was interesting because it was like Diana Rigg's last film, and that was the great thing. But it's what I loved about it. There's a wonderful moment where the girl emerges from a thing, and she emerges into the cinema playing Thunderball. It's a wonderful image.
Have you actually seen it, Charles?
No.
It's basically somebody transcending time. So she goes back in time to, and there's kind of murder and noir and stuff. And it's got a really great, the funny thing is anybody who has worked in Soho will get where the streets are. And I've worked in Soho. So the funny thing is you think, oh, so that's Soho Square and that's Greek Street and that's Fifth Street.
Yeah.
But the wonderful thing is it's a wonderful moment of digital cinema.
Sorry, lower your chair down a bit so you're closer to that mic because it's getting a lot of
echo. Okay, okay.
That's it.
So there's a wonderful moment which I loved, which is it shows the Rialto Cinema in Coventry Street, and it's showing Thunderball when it first opened because it played at the London Pavilion and it played the Rialto, and it was also where they held the London premieres. So when Sean Connery came in, it was a difference because the London Pavilion, which is where the Ridley's Believe It or Not, that used to be a main thing. It's where I think A Hard Day's Night premiered in 1964, I think it is. But I loved it visually. I mean, it's not a great movie. Not a great movie. And I think it could have done with some work, but it had a kind of a nostalgia moment about it.
But it turns into a horror that you don't see coming. And then it just goes
off the rails.
It angered me how bad it was. Chucked the end together. You know, one of those you go, hang on, what?
Where did this come from?
Yeah. But it's
those can work. You know, they can work.
But it also has to have, you know, I think also you have to be very cleverly structured. I was talking to a crime writer at Fright Fest, and they said to me, and I asked her, I said, well, when you're starting a crime novel, what do you start with? And you know what she said?
Well, crime.
The body,
yeah, the crime.
Because ultimately, it's like about Columbo. Ultimately, it's about the discovery of a body. I mean, if you look at, say, for example, Blood Simple by the Coen Brothers, and that's what we'll be talking about, cult films. It's the fact that it's always about double crosses, and somebody will die. Somebody has to die in the thing. But with Last Night in Soho, it was a case of style over content. If you watch Dario Argento movies, it's the gore, you know, it's the moments in the film that actually make it. It's not the actual plot. It doesn't quite work.
Well, anyway, so don't watch it. I forgot I was going to text you and Andrew to say, right, I'm so angry. Do not watch this film just out of protest.
I want to watch it now. Sounds good. It's interesting.
It looks good. But the ending is just like...
directed again? It's,
I think it's Edgar Wright.
Oh, yeah, I think so, yeah.
Which, again, he's a director who I think is very talented. He's one of the best, but watching Baby Driver, for example, which is his film, which has, like, Jamie Foxx and John Hamm and...
Kevin Spacey,
Lily James, Ansel Elgort. Yeah. Ansel Elgort, you know, and... it's got kind of, like, influence from, like, The Driver and, you know, those kind of movies.
Right, so we're going to get going. Anyway, it's nice to see you again.
Yes, it's nice to be back. It's nice to be back.
Every time we haven't got a collection of studios, John. We have moved from studio to studio.
But the thing is, it's as long, you know, the studios may same, but the enthusiasm stays the same.
And we've come closer to the sort of movie heart of London. Yeah. So you're sort of like the Predator. We see you ever as Heatwave.
The difference is I don't change shape and become invisible. Yeah. And I don't sort of kill people and say, and cause on it, say, it was skinned alive.
Yes. Have they left that alone now, Predator? Is that left? They've sort of left.
I doubt it. There's probably some another one. They had one of the ones on film four last night. Predators. I think it'll be Predator versus Arnie next. I think. I don't know.
Predator versus
CG Arnie.
Yeah.
Well, with AI and the stuff going on, you never know. You know.
Well, before we start, what's happening with the strike in America?
Well, at the moment, it's a very interesting. It's an odd one because they've got waivers so that you can actually try and cast the film, can't make anything. So my feeling is, I mean,
so you're allowed to do a bit of pre-production.
You're allowed to do pre-production and casting, but you can't sort of do. So, for example, I interviewed Catherine, Diane Franklin for a new short film, Pareidolia. She was in Amityville 2. And she was also in The Last American Virgin. She's in a new short film called Pareidolia, which is a Fright Fest. But when we did the interview, she said to me, look, I can talk to you about the movies, but I can't tell you what they are. You know, I know I can't say Amityville 2 or that, because the way she said it, it's like, if I sort of say a title, then somebody will seek it out on streaming and it's a victory for them.
Oh,
right.
There's a moratorium on promoting.
So, for example, it's affected things like the Venice Film Festival. So what's happened is they can have Z-listers, but I think Adam Driver is the only one who's turned up. He's done a movie about Ferrari. And so I think Woody Allen's turned up, but it's happened actually at the premiere of...
Woody Allen. I saw that, and he got booed, and like people, and he was outraged.
For example, the new Emma Stone film, which is Yorgos Lanthimos' film, that's just got like the award, but nobody turned up. Mm-hmm. That, for example, it could affect the BFI London Film Festival. It could also affect, you know, the awards season, because, you know, for example, it actually happened. It actually went live the minute the Oppenheimer premiere went. So all the stars turned up at the Oppenheimer premiere Christian Nolan said, sorry, they've gone off to write their picket board. So, I think it's going to level out because AI is a tool that's going to, you know, so, you know, they're going to want to work, you know, people are going to want to work again. You know, do you think the A-listers are going to miss out on their work? I doubt it. It's not affecting things in this country because Equity and SAG are actually not affected. So they can make movies. I think one of the other things is there was a movie that premiered in Venice, which was in Canada, and that was okay and stuff like that. But with SAG and the Writers Guild of America, they're saying that it could go on to the end of the year. But
where does their SAG, if you leave the country and do a film in England, do they still fall under SAG?
If it's got a star that is in part of the Screen Actors Guild, then yes, it does affect it.
Doesn't matter what country they're in.
Yeah. Because there are actors, you know, you could, like Florence Pugh, I think she, you know, there's a lot of these people turning up at the strike. So Florence Pugh was there doing a bit of promotion and, you know, so it's, we'll see what happens. But
and who are they striking against? Who's got the power?
What they're striking against is because with AI, for example, it's like the background artists. So, for example, that, you know, with AI, and AI can actually affect somebody like a physical actor working. Why would anybody want to do a physical thing when they can actually employ an?
But who's got the power? Who's the opposite of the actor? Who are they trying?
It's the streaming services like Netflix and Paramount, and you know the studios are. There's a major concern that, you know, they're worried that, you know, it's going to cost jobs. But the truth is the reality is it's like anything. It's out
there.
It's
just changing.
It's like, it's another change. It happens every single time there's a strike. It happened, you know, there's writer strikes throughout the thing. There was one around the time of Jaws. There was one around the time of like, Fatal Attraction and The Accused and stuff. You know, Sean Connery, when he got his Oscar for, The Untouchables, mentioned it at his awards. You know, we've got to sort out the writer strike. Yeah. But it's phases in the industry. It's what happens.
Right. Yeah.
So
this is automation. This is, unfortunate.
But it's a tool. AI is a tool. There will be a leveling out because AI, one of the other debates is whether AI can write scripts. And they said, no, it's not going to make people write scripts because writers are writers. You know, human beings will, you know, you can't, you know, somebody like, I don't know, Christopher Nolan or Quentin Tarantino, you know, it's a computer.
Yeah.
Somebody's got to program the bloody thing, you know. So anyway.
Right. So what are we doing today, then, John?
We're doing cult films.
Cult films.
So.
Yes. Now, John, what is a cult film?
Well, the rule is that a cult film is not a cult film. The reason is a cult film becomes a cult film because when a film is created, it goes out into the cinema. And sometimes the common element is that it fails initially. So.
So it maybe didn't find an audience.
It didn't find an audience at the time. But what happens is, and what you'll notice is the films we're going to be talking about are actually films that actually found an audience later on. Norman Jewison said that when he did his film called A Soldier's Story back in 1985, he said that a film will, whatever happens, a film created today will find its audience tomorrow, whatever happens. So if you, you know, it may not get the right promotion. Donnie Darko, for example, is a movie that, for example, that sort of didn't really do any business, yeah. But it then became a this interesting thing because in the context of 9/11, because there's a scene in it where there's a plane that falls and all of a sudden, it's also about tapping into the mindset of the audience. If you take, for example, Star Wars, for example, Star Wars before it opened was regarded as a doom project. Then all of a sudden it captured the audience and things like that. Terminator, for example, was a low budget movie that sort of elevated itself and became a hit because all the other movies you were talking about, Dune before. James Cameron said that Doom was going to be the blockbuster, but Terminator became a sleeper hit. Oh, yeah. So it's kind of a middle ground. So
the thing, John Carpenter's a thing, wasn't it? It's not a cult. What was it?
That could be because again, that was a movie that sort of didn't do well. Yeah. It opened
and then rocketed up. To...
And then it's like if they'd released it in October of 82, it would have been had more impact because it's not a summer movie.
Right, yeah.
It's a very downbeat movie that, you know, is very, very good. It's for me, it's sort of elevated itself because of the fans.
And wasn't E.T. the problem? Was it released near or
it
after?
It was released about 2 weeks after E.T.
Right, so everyone's in a lovely...
Everybody's kind of said, well, look, we want a cuddly alien that sort of phones home and sort of dies and then comes back. And, you know, Spielberg wanted, you know, I think one of the things they wanted an emotional cry. It fulfilled the needs of the audience with the thing. It was like, look,
grotesque.
People are dying, but the thing about it is when you look at the thing about the thing, is that it's now become, when you look at COVID, for example, in the context of COVID, you know, it seems plausible. It's actually plausible. It's now something evil inside of you that's killing the humanity. It's, you know, we've just been through it. So, but, you know, and then all of a sudden we've had all these lockdown movies. But the thing is, like, with a lot of John Carpenter's films, you know, that they have sort of were ahead of their time, you know, and he's a filmmaker who I think he's very smart and he created a body of work, which is incredible. And The Thing is probably one of his best. Mm-hmm. So
right, we know what cult films are now. Then, let's go.
I've got five titles here, which really, which I'm going to talk about, which in a way have context and relativity, and are titles that actually have grown in stature afterwards because they weren't as well received. So this is my top five. So number five, Streets of Fire.
No.
Okay, so
what year is this?
This is 1984. So this is actually one of Walter Hill's follow-ups to The Warriors. And it's described as a rock and roll fable.
Who does that have in the start? That has...
It's Michael Paré, Diane Lane, Willem Dafoe, Rick Moranis.
Rick Moranis, yeah, that's...
And essentially what it is it's Jim Steinman music. So like the guy who did Bat Out of Hell. And the story is this. Ellenheim, it's a nameless city, nameless town, and it's a homecoming concert by this singer called Ellenheim, played by Diane Lane. And she basically performs, and before she's had a chance to even do two songs, the bad guy, Willem Dafoe, turns up with a bunch of bikers and kidnaps her. So essentially, the cafe owner, Reva, played by Deborah Van Valkenburg, who was in The Warriors, she summons her brother, Tom Cody, played by Michael Paré, who was Ellenheim's ex-boyfriend, to come home and go after her. And essentially, she goes after her. Rick Moranis is the manager, Billy Fish, who's Diane Lane's boyfriend, and then they go off on an adventure. Amy Madigan plays a soldier called McCoy. Bill Paxton is a barman who gets whacked by Amy Madigan in the film.
Who's Bill Paxton?
Paxton, he played Hudson in Aliens.
Yeah, oh, that is him, yeah.
And so what it is they...
Well, I mean, he must have been... How old? Oh, Wang, was this 84?
84, oh, okay, yeah. Right. So it was 2 years before it. But essentially, they go off and there's like music and stuff. It's a movie that failed when it first came out. But if you watch the first 10 minutes of it, it's like a graphic novel. It's a gloriously musical soundtrack. Graphic novel. It's like a 50s rock and roll film, like The Wild One. Mm. But it's got like an 80s soundtrack. It's got Dan Hartman's I Can Dream About You. It's got a Marilyn Martin song called Sorcerer written by Stevie Nicks. She did a duet with Phil Collins, Separate Lives, for the film White Nights. And it's such a curiosity because it's nothing like anything that was ever released in the 80s. It's also produced by Joel Silver, who did Lethal Weapon and Thing. But when you watch Streets of Fire, it actually has elements of the Lethal Weapon, the actual action films from there. So the opening sequence is like that. It's also got a style like The Warriors. It's got the same kind of style, but it's a wonderful exercise in style. Great soundtrack. Didn't do all that well. A bit so like the
Walter Hill.
It was a bit like the Blues Brothers, another movie, similar kind of thing, you know, music and action and carnage and violence. But it's one of those that has grown in stature over the years. It's a movie that kind of found its audience later on terms of on DVD. And there's a great Blu-ray. It's on YouTube Movies if you ever get a chance. Plays of the Prince Charles, still very good. Always a good draw as a film. So that's my fifth one. It's described as a rock and roll fable, and if you watch the trailers, it's like one of those in a world where, you know, that kind of thing. But
those 80s trailers are great. Yeah.
But there's actually a YouTube channel dedicated called YouTube Retro where they've actually got real time trailers. So if you go on like Ghostbusters and it ends with the black card for like whatever film it is. So that's my fifth one. Number four is Mad Max.
Okay.
So this is...
Did that not do well when it came out then?
This is an interesting one because it was part of the Australian New Wave. Now, I would say it did very good business overall, but it's more... At the time, it was more of a cult film because in America, they did a very strange thing because they didn't believe people could understand Australian accents. They dubbed it into an American English.
Really?
And it was this version that was released to UK cinemas in 1979. The problem is the second film, Mad Max 2, became such a hot thing. It premiered in Tokyo in late 1981. In America, because nobody had seen Mad Max and because it tanked because of this audition, they retitled it The Road Warrior. And, you know, it was made for like $100,000. It was a very low budget thing. George Miller didn't have any faith in it. It was sort of catering for the times.
I think that was his van as well, wasn't it? That gets smashed. There's a bit where where it goes boom. Actually totals like.
But it's got
that was the director's van. He was like, yeah, okay, we'll use that.
But there are some incredible things in it because it is again, you know, that it's part of the Australian New Wave. So people like Fred Chappice, Philip Noyce, Peter Weir, they all went on to do films in America.
Right.
You know, Philip Noyce did Clear and Present Danger. Peter Weir did Dead Poets Society. Fred Chappice did Cry in the Dark and a couple of things. He did a film called The Chance of Jimmy Blacksmith, which was a very brutal, violent film about Aborigines and stuff. But Mad Max actually has the look of a cult film. You know, if you look at Mad Max Fury Road, for example, the whole essence of it is this big budget thing, which cost more than four times the combined budgets of the first three Mad Maxes. But it's a film that has been elevated. It's a movie, again, which has increased in stature because people have watched in repeat viewings. People have caught it in on cable or on DVD or VHS. Later versions now have the original Australian dialogue, so it's been done like that.
Mm.
But at the time, it was more of a cult film. It was Mel Gibson's debut in the film. It was the film.
So it was an Australian film. The whole thing.
It was an Australian film. Right, yeah.
Okay.
The first one is a slightly old film, and I do think that it sort of has.
Does his family get killed at the beginning?
The whole story is it's set in the near future, and there's a thing called the Main Force Patrol. So Mel Gibson plays Max Rokitansky. He's got a wife and daughter, and he gets blamed because there's a guy called the Knight Rider who's running riot in the opening chase, and it's the sequence you're talking about where. And it's absolute carnage. One van gets bloody whacked and swirled around. There's a guy called Jim Goose, played by Steve Bisley, who's eating in a thing, and he sort of gets chased. And then essentially Mad Max goes after Knight Rider, and Knight Rider dies in a ball of flames. Later on, there's a group of people called the Tollcutter, played by Hugh Keyes Byrne, and they basically sort of attack a couple. And another guy called Johnny the Boy, played by Tim Burns, he sort of blabs his mouth and gets summoned, but because of a legal technicality, he's set free. Goose swears revenge. Johnny the Boy sort of kills Goose.
Isn't Goose a Morton Joe as well, I think? Hmm? Goose, he plays a Morton Joe, doesn't he?
No, Hugh Keyes Byrne's playing
Morton. Morton.
Yeah, so essentially, Max is very disillusioned with the road. He's like the king of the road, and he quits. But after Jim, you know, he quits, and then all of a sudden comes into contact with the gang. The gang kill his wife and child on the road, and then Mad Max wears revenge. And
how many years was it before the second one came out?
Second one was 2 years. It came.
Was that it?
Yeah, it was.
But how comes if it wasn't the first one wasn't that popular?
No, it was popular elsewhere in the world.
Oh, right, okay, it came back.
It was very popular in Australia. Mad Max 2.
It was quite low budget as well, so it did make a lot of money. It made quite relatively, but I think because of the low budget, it did very well.
You got a lot for your money, though, didn't you? So like, it feels like it's a low budget film, but when you think about it, there seems to be a lot going on for that low budget amount of money.
They did,
which is a handful of cars and
the
desert.
A little, didn't they?
Yeah.
And I like that. I like the point that it's a point of society just collapsing, like just about to. Yeah. And well, there's still courts and there's still a police force,
George Miller was a doctor. And the reason why the kind of reality of the violence, because he actually he trained as a doctor and then he worked on with Byron Kennedy. And they wrote a script with a journalist called, James McCausland. And the whole thing is the actual, you know, but then of course the second one led to the idea of society breaking down about the oil. There was an oil crisis at the time. So they then created the idea of the black fuel. And so fuel became the currency. And then of course you had the spectacle, but it's a movie that's, today, when you view it, it's amazing. There's no CGI. It's all in camera.
Yeah.
You know, Mad Max Fury Road is a film in camera. It's a bit like Christopher Nolan stuff. It's one of the last of the in-camera blockbusters. Mm. And Mad Max is a cult film for that reason.
Right.
So that's my fourth one. Now, my third one is Falling Down.
Okay.
So this is the Michael Douglas and Joel Schumacher. So it's a very un-PC film. But again, it's a movie that I think is more of a cult film. It's a studio film, but it has a very valid thing to say. The Woke Brigade will probably hate it for anything.
Yeah, why? What was it? I can't remember.
Well, it's such an un-PC film because it's about a guy called Defense, Bill Foster.
Yeah.
And one day in a heated traffic jam like today, he has a nervous breakdown. And he decides he's going to go. He tells this other guy, I'm going home. At the same time, the traffic jam, a cop called Prendergast, played by Robert Duvall, is on his way to work for his retirement. And he sort of comes across the vehicle. And there's a place called Defense, D-F-E-N-S. Mm. Michael Douglas climbs over the fence and goes to a Korean shopkeeper and says, I want some change. And the shopkeeper says, I want, you got to buy something. And of course, and then they get into this argument over a soda. Right. And then it sort of escalates. So he ends up in a gangland with some Latinos and they sort of get beaten up. Then he goes to he meets a homeless guy in the park. And then he goes to a burger bar where he goes mad because they stop serving breakfast at 11:30.
There's elements where you can, you know, he's like, yeah, I can see where this goes. I think it's a very interesting film because he's not a traditional hero.
Yeah.
He is a bit of, in any other film, he'd be an antagonist.
Yeah.
And that Robert Duvall is, you're sort of like, oh, this is a bad dude. He's going to do bad things. I get where he's coming from. But then the Robert Duvall character, you sort of expect to have more of a role, I think, and become the protagonist.
But I think there's a real dynamic balance. I think the reason why, because it did actually have it caused the stir at the time because around the time of the Rodney King riots. And they actually had to stop filming at one point because they were filming in areas where that thing was happening. But it's a film that I think today, for example, if you, it wouldn't be made today because you'd have studio execs saying, well, this is a bit too resistant, but it has something valid to say about society and about the mental health and mental breakdown.
Yeah.
I think it's a movie that, you know, there's a neo-Nazi guy played by Frederick Forrest who actually sort of is very homophobic. He sort of goes after it. And there's a scene, interesting comment where he says, you and Guy are alike. He goes, no, I just want to get home to see my family. Cause he's, spoiler alert, he's actually up trying to meet his wife, ex-wife, Barbara Hershey in Venice. But the moral of the film is actually in Robert Duvall. Cause again, he's retiring. He's got a overbearing wife who wants to take him to Lake Havasu, New Jersey. You got Rachel Tickerton, who's his partner. And everybody in the police precinct doesn't really, he's the one that's actually sort of seen how this is panning out and he's trying to solve it. He's not trying to solve it for any glory. He's actually doing stuff. And then the interesting thing is that the final denouement, which is at the pier where Michael Douglas says, I am the bad guy. How did that happen? And then of course, you know, and there's an interesting exchange between Robert Duvall and stuff. Apologies for the spoiler, but I need to do it as context. But do watch the movie because it's very much, you know, it. I think it's a movie that needs to be made and it's a movie that needs to be seen. I think we need to have valid discussions and constructive discussions about what we do make. I think everything's been kind of called out at the moment for cancel culture. You know, you can't say certain words, you can't say certain identities. And this film, I mean, there's one very controversial scene on a golf course. Where he's walking across and he's sort of, and there's a couple of old guys and they're sort of playing thing. He goes, I'm, what are you doing? He goes, I'm passing through. He goes, no, nobody said you could play for him. And then he says, you know, and he throws the ball. And then of course he shoots the golf cart and he goes, where are your pills? He goes, they're in the cart. He goes, well, now you're going to die wearing that little hat. It's very crazy black comedy. It's a very adult film. And I like it for its, because I think it's a well-constructive screenplay. It's one of the best films of the 90s. I think if I was going to do my list, I would put it up there with.
I'm surprised you classed it as a cult film. Did it not do well at the time?
It did okay. I wouldn't say it did too well because it wasn't a blockbuster. It came out the same year as The Fugitive, which was much bigger for Warner Brothers. But I do feel it has a kind of the studio film with a cult sensitivity. Right. It's a movie that, like most cult films, it's not something for everyone, but there are people who have its fans. It polarizes opinions. Yeah.
It's a mainstream film without that mainstream sensibility.
Yeah, that's right.
And I do think it's okay. I mean, because it is, I think it's one of those films, I think of it like sort of Taxi Driver, in that Taxi Driver is a film about a racist, a person who is quite racist, who murders people, and but it is not a racist film.
It's not these.
And same thing with Fall Down. It's not. It touches on these things, but I don't think it's necessary because it doesn't present these as a positive. You know?
It's not. It's a very negative film. But the truth is society, because of what it tells and what it's trying to say in its approach. You know, the whole idea. You know, when this guy loses it, like over the fact that he berates people for, he takes a bazooka and blows up a street because what's wrong with the street? And then he blows a thing and goes, "I'll give you something to fix." But it's a movie that I think, you know, you have to sort of look to the deeper themes about what it represents. It's not an easy film to watch. I'm saying that, but I think it's, you know, it touches on, you know. But it's about a guy who breaks down. It's about a guy with mental health. It's not an easy thing to, you know, and, you know, some people will go, whoa, what the hell is this? This is quite a shocking film. But if you're an intellect, if you've got a much more desire to look for something deeper, there's some interesting things in there.
Do you know what rating it was? Was it a 15?
It's 18.
Oh, it was 80. It was 18. Even then.
I do think a lot of that is because it puts him front and center. It puts the defense front
but
and
center. But that's the thing about films is the fact that sometimes when you look at things like Natural Born Killers, you know, or Reservoir Dogs or Pulp Fiction, you know, if you look at the scene in Pulp Fiction where the guy gets blown up, you know, gets killed in the car, you know, it's such a shock, but it shows the logistics of the violence, you know, the fact that they've got to clean up the thing, you know, shows violence is messy.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Right. So that's the number four, three.
So number two, I think we can't sort of pass off the moment without talking about Blade Runner.
It's a cult, yeah. Okay.
It's a, so this is a this is an interesting one because it is a cult. It is a cult film, and it is a movie that again defies expectations and because of what's happened for it. Because it's a movie that failed, yet it still spawned the sequel.
That also didn't do
it failed,
particularly
did it?
Well.
No, the sequel did really well. There was a
the original one failed.
The original one failed when it first came out. It was part of the 1982 thing because it was so intellectual and stuff like that. But again, it was a movie that, you know, sort of found its audience on video. So the legend goes, if you read Paul M. Salmon's book, Future War, the Making of Blade Runner, which is the definitive book, you know, the reason why you've got all these versions is because of a guy called Michael Arick who discovered a test print when he was doing some research for sound preservation. And he came across this print of Blade Runner, and it was a 70 millimeter print. And he checked it. He said, oh, this is Blade Runner. He assumed that it was an original version. But when they played it as part of a 1990 70 millimeter festival, it was not the version. So this work print then became a sensation, was started to play with sellout crowds. And then it built and built. Ridley Scott got involved. And then he sort of created the director's cut in 1992. Then you had the
I remember there was so much hype. I mean, I was about 8 or 9. I remember there was a lot of hype in that.
But again, it's a movie that, again, it's a mix of science fiction and Raymond Chandler, like by Humphrey Bogart, because Harrison Ford is a detective assigned to track down replicants. But it's also, you know, it's a movie that's proved to be so influential now because people, whenever they make futuristic films now, it's impossible to think of a futuristic world without thinking of the world that Lawrence G. Paul and Sid Mead created, like flying cars. You know, we have like the video stuff. We have like the searching of the rooms, you know, all the technology, which was in its infancy at the time, was actually very much, you know, you look at sort of laptops and you look at like the being able to search a room or dealing with that, you know, fingerprint identification, you know.
What year did it come out?
1982. And it's based on...
And it was Ridley Scott.
It was Ridley Scott.
What was his film before that? What did he do before?
Alien.
Oh, right. Yeah, he was big. That's why I was wondering how it failed. You think, I thought he must have been...
It's, you know, every movie is a success up until the time that it's released. Yeah. You know, and the problem was, is at the time, it was 1982. It was released in June of 82, around the same time as Poltergeist, Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, E.T. It was, you know, even Michael Dealey, who was the producer, he said, oh, I was hoping E.T. would fall, but E.T. had legs. Right. It was a very interesting thing. You know, the whole idea is, you know, but it's found its audience. You know, people think it's an intellectual, you know, it's a very intelligent science fiction, but you have to spend about 5 viewings before you understand what the bloody thing's about. Okay. But again, it has, you know, I mean, you know, I fell in love with Sean Young as Rachel. I mean, Giant Cassidy as the Snake Woman. You had Daryl Hannah. You had Rutger Hauer, who played Roy Batty. I mean, he has probably one of the most famous climactic lines ever.
One of the best monologues, one of the most memorable monologues.
But it's a movie, you know, when you look at the opening sequences, when you have the cars chasing and they're moving around and, but the logistics, the reason why they did it was the antithesis of what futuristic films were at the time. Because at the time you had things like Logan's Run. So the idea of Buck Rogers, it was kind of like, oh, we have these pristine, clean things. But the thing is, their idea was it would be too expensive to tear these down and build up. So they built on top of them. So it was actually, it was partly modeled on Ridley Scott's interpretation of Los Angeles.
Yeah.
You know, but when you think about it, you know, it was 2017 or whatever, 2019, you know, Blade Runner 2019. It's like, you know, the world is more in keeping with what, you know, what it's more in keeping with what, you know, the world is now. We may not have flying cars, but we have, you know, we have a lot of the technology that was kind of given.
Yeah.
You know, but what's interesting, if you look at like films like, say, Escape from New York, 1997, it's like, you know, the funny thing is I watched Escape from LA recently and it has like a mad president taking over because, Cliff Robertson plays like a Trump and it's 2013 and you think, well, that's actually it. Cause he talks, it's about simple thing, but it's fantastic because I think it's a movie that, where the future has caught up that they've kind of crystallized and we now have a, you know, a world that is more in, you know, the Blade Runner future is actually in keeping with where we are today.
I suppose it's
like Star Trek has a thing where basically technology will fix our problems, and that eventually, you know, there will be free fuel and medicine and everything. All these problems we have now will be fixed eventually by technology. And there's a sort of different view where sort of technology creates new problems. It fixes some things, but creates new problems.
Yeah. But also issues. The idea of going back to the issue of AI at the moment, with the idea of human replicants, you know, the idea of humans, you know, is technology going to get to the point where, you know, and we have seen it. I know there's somebody who's, they had a thing on Good Morning Britain where there was a woman who was approaching it. And but the idea is, but that's the interesting thing is, you know, when you look at technology and the fact that how we view things, how we, you know, when you look at, you know, there's scenes where Harrison Ford's talking to Rachel on a TV screen and now we have Zoom and stuff like that. Yeah. So it's, I put it as a cult film because again, it was a cult film at the time. It's sort of been elevated. The whole legacy of Blade Runner, it's become broader. So that's why I think, that's why I've named it as, it's important that we do include Blade Runner because of its influence and because it was a film that evolved as an audience, as a film. And, you know, and I think it's also like a mainstream film now, but it wasn't a mainstream film at the time. It was a film that sort of was a studio film, didn't make a lot of money. And then, you know, it sort of found its audience like The Thing or the others.
So number one.
Well, number one for me is Assault on Precinct 13, 1976.
Oh, yeah. So I haven't seen this, but I know of it.
It's one of my favorite John Carpenter films.
Is it John Carpenter?
Yeah.
So here is
an interesting bit of history, right? Assault on Precinct 13 bombed in America in 1976. In 1977, it played at the London Film Festival and grew in stature. It was more successful in England because of that. So here's an interesting fact. The distributor of Assault on Precinct 13 in the UK was Miracle Films. Who was the head of Miracle Films? Some guy called Michael Myers. As a tribute to the work that they did for Assault in London, John Carpenter named the killer in Halloween Michael Myers.
Oh, blimey.
I bet he was like, thanks.
Yes.
I actually met him about 30 years. I mean, he was a lovely guy. His son Martin Myers ran First Independence and stuff. But I went to a screening at the BFI South Bank of In the Mouth of Madness, and he was there in the audience. And actually, he said that we were actually thinking of doing it, but we didn't take it because entertainment took it over. But it's this film sort of, if it wasn't for the fact that the film was a success in England, we might not have even had Halloween. Because it was Erwin Yablans, who was the executive producer, said that, he said that if it had not been for his success in England, well, I would not have had the courage to do it. So when you think about it, a whole industry and the whole slasher genre might not have happened on this moment. So what is this movie about? Forget the 2005 remake with Ethan Hawke and Lawrence Fishburne.
Yeah, I've seen that one.
I've seen it and I completely forgot.
Because it actually... So the story is this. It's basically a reimagining of Howard Hawks' Rio Bravo, a Western from 1951. It has the kind of basic elements, but what happened is John Carpenter was approached by an investor from Philadelphia and given $200,000 to make a movie. And he wanted to make Westerns because Carpenter wanted to make Westerns. He got caught up in horror and he did that, but he basically said, I'm going to do a modern day Western and stylize with Indians, gangs as Indians and stuff like that. So the basic story is this. Lieutenant Ethan Bishop, played by Austin Stoker, is on his first night out as a lieutenant, and he's then assigned to go to Precinct 9, Division 13. There's a bit of a discrepancy because in the film it's known as Precinct 13, but it's Division 9, Precinct 9, Division 13.
But it sounds cooler.
Sounds cool. So essentially he goes off to this thing, which is closing down. They're moving over to a new station. Into this mix comes a father and daughter. Basically, all the gangs of Los Angeles are swearing revenge for... six members of a gang called Street Thunder. They get killed at the beginning of the film. They get blown away, stuff like that. And essentially they swear revenge. They have a thing called the Cholo, which is a blood oath to the death. There's a bunch of prisoners being transferred and they're going to some prison elsewhere. Among them is Napoleon Wilson, the most evil prisoner, who has Darwin Justin, who has the best lines in the film. He talks about
he got a smoke
and you know, he doesn't stand up as good as he used to. So essentially one of the other prisoners in this van gets taken ill, and the only precinct is precinct 13.
Right.
Also into this mix is a father and daughter. Kathy, played by Kim Richards, who was in the Witch Mountain film. She was in 1976. So, of course, they're driving through this neighborhood to pick up the grandparents. The father stops to make a phone call, said, we're going to pick up Margaret, blah, blah, blah. And the kid goes off to an ice cream van, just as one of the gang members comes along and shoots the guy. The gang member shoots the kid. Kids on the ground, and then the father swears revenge. They sort of,
I have to say, it is quite brutal. I mean, it's a strange film because it sort of has a bit of unreality about it, and it is a bit sort of fantastical, but I like that about it. But then the bit where the little girl gets killed, you're like,
but the funny thing is if you watch that, actually what it is a gun squirting, but what they've done now in the later versions, they've actually done a sound effect, so it actually is heightened. Yeah. But at the time, the funny story, there's an interesting, there's an interview they did in 2002 where, they were talking about, Carpenter talked about, he said, we had a rating, and they talked about the scene where the girl got blown, and they said, look, you've got to cut out the girl being killed, otherwise you'll get an X. So basically the producer said, just take that bit out, show them the film, and then just put it back in when you do
that. Bloody hell.
So essentially what it is, they all convene at the police station. They're then trapped in, and then all of a sudden the whole thing is, it just becomes, they're being shot, and the gang members are using silencers. In the remake, they're allowed to leave there. So it's a kind of a weird combination. But the wonderful thing is it's the use of the guns and the silences is an incredible sequence. And it leads to this wonderful moment where they blow up the thing and there's like everything's being blown up, like windows being blown up.
Yeah.
And then it's essentially the cops and the criminals working together to survive. And you've got like two secretaries, Lee and Julie, played by Laurie Zimmer and Nancy Loomis, who went on to be in Halloween. But it's one of those movies where, you know, it's got such a wonderful power about it. I mean, it's got a great score, which John Carpenter did, which mixes up Led Zeppelin. And the theme of it is actually a mixture of Led Zeppelin and Lalo Schifrin from Dirty Harry, if you listen to it. But what's great about it is it's a movie that looks 10 times more expensive because it's the widescreen, because they actually shot it at a studio just opposite Paramount. Raleigh Studios was where Kevin Costner worked as a stage manager at one point. But it's literally the studios where they shot it is actually over the road from Paramount, because I found that out because I went to Los Angeles back in 2006 and I actually saw it. It is one of my favorite John Carpenter films. I think it still stands up today because of, you know, even though it's very much a film of the 70s, it has some wonderful stylist moments. And Douglas Knapp's cinematography is probably amongst the best. There's another sequence which stands out for me, which is where after the father kills the kid, again, sorry about the spoilers, but these are just the moments. And he goes to a phone booth and he's looking out, and all of a sudden he sees this gang member with a gun just walking out the camera, not dissimilar to Michael Myers approaching, going after Jamie Lee Curtis in The Thing. It's also unique because it has a black protagonist with Austin Stoker, who passed away recently. He's absolutely brilliant because he's not dissimilar to Dwayne Jones in Night of the Living Dead. But but Darwin Justin, who plays Napoleon Wilson, is actually absolutely brilliant. I think he steals the show because he has some wonderful moments. There's a scene where him and Tony Burston, who played like the Apollo's, Ringman in Rocky.
Oh, right. Yeah,
and there's a wonderful scene where they're saying, you know, they're trying to debate whether to go, who's going to go to the car and hot wire the car. And he goes, well, let's settle it one way. Let's do potatoes. And they're actually going like So it, but the wonderful thing is that it, there's some really interesting moments of gallows humor, not dissimilar to Die Hard. There's, it has the same kind of wonderful gallows humor that it has. So, you know, like, and Charles Cyphers, who plays the guy who's then he was in Halloween, he was in The Fog and stuff like that. So there's a lot of interesting, there's a lot of people, who sort of work with Carpenter later on. So the art director of the film was Tommy Lee Wallace, who went on to do the, art direction of Halloween, directed Halloween 3. Mm-hmm. The script supervisor and assistant editor were Deborah Hill, who produced Halloween and went on and, you know, until and carried on working until they died. And
so it's a foundational Carpenter movie.
It's a, if you watch it, the, but as I say, the whole kind of style of it, because Mustafa, you know, like the, you know, Owen Yablans and people like that, you know, it's interesting to see that. I mean, the other thing is as well, the editor of the film was a guy called John T. Chance. That was Carpenter because it was named in homage because John Carpenter was a Howard Hawks fan.
Oh, right.
And that's why, you know, like Halloween, for example, has the thing showing on the TV.
Hang on. So is that why he did the thing?
Yeah. It's his, one of his favorite films.
Yeah. Yeah.
But he was already, being touted by, David Foster and Lawrence Terman. They wanted him to do the film.
Oh, okay.
You know, he was already doing it because it was in production. But again, that's why they had the scene in the, that's why you see the film on the TV when Jamie Lee Curtis is babysitting.
Oh, okay.
And they also show like Forbidden Planet. Yeah. So yeah, so that to me is my favorite cult film.
I want, do you know, what was the Schwarzenegger film that really tanked? He spent a lot of money. Last Action Hero?
Last Action Hero.
I think that film was ahead of its time, you know. I only saw it about a year ago. I think at the time it was too sophisticated for audience.
Here's the thing about Last Action Hero. It was, the thing about Arnold Schwarzenegger at the time, you've got to think about the context of it, because he'd done Terminator 2.
Yeah.
And become like arrogant and the big star. John McTiernan had done Die Hard and Predator, you know, and again, it was, you know, it was a movie that again, it's a tricky one because again, it had a kid as the thing. So you, the problem is
slightly wacky.
It had an interesting idea. So the idea of an action hero suddenly being catapulted into the real world. It was a bit like the Purple Rose of Cairo. That was the thing. It wasn't a new concept because Woody Allen's film, The Purple Rose of Cairo, is about Jeff Daniels and he's an actor because Mia Farrow goes to watch this film, The Purple Rose of Cairo. And at one point, Jeff Daniels turns to the screen and says to Mia Farrow, you like this film. And then he ends up going out into the real world. So it wasn't a new concept, but the thing about it is it was hyped up as the big ticket for 1993.
Yeah, it was way too hyped up.
The other thing as well is again, it failed because there was this other little film, which you might've heard of called Jurassic Park at the time, which again was pioneering CGI. And that was the big ticket for 1993. Yeah. It was. Again, the combination of when you have a kid as the protagonist against Arnold Schwarzenegger, you know, you are fighting two audiences, you know, is it a kid film?
Yeah, that's the only thing. It was like a kiddie fantasy was creeping in. And I thought, without that, if you had made it a little bit, because the protagonist, what's the guy's name?
Jack Slater.
Yeah, he's the
the antagonist. Oh, Charles Dance.
Yeah, that's it. He was a good character.
It has one of my the funniest bits. I love it when you go, when Charles Dance goes.
I think I know what you're going to say, go on.
And then he just walks a lot and then he just shoots.
Exactly.
And like,
I've just killed the man.
I just killed the man. And then someone goes, shut up.
But what I like is when he said to me, he goes, in this world, the bad guys can win.
Yeah.
It's got a lot of, you know, but I think also as well, it's sort of, people are now sort of warming to it in a way, which is, you know, I think the problem is because there's this desire to see a film sort of, because a film has to open and it has to open well, if a movie, you know, it costs, I mean,
especially when it's cost,
you know, and then you have to think about marketing costs and stuff like that. So today, for example, you have, for example, the, the Marvel films. Now, the Marvel films, and you know, if you look at Barbie and Oppenheimer, you know, Barbie, you know, I did Barbieheimer and I like both movies, but it's, but again, it, you know, I didn't think, to be honest with you, when I looked at Barbie, I was thinking, again, I think, is this movie, you know, it's kind of an odd one because it's about toys, but is this movie, has he got the legs to do it? It was like, I went to the premiere of Titanic back in 97. It was the London premiere. I went to the Royal Film Performance. And again, because I wanted to see it because it was 200 million. And I was thinking in there, and I, when it came out, I was thinking, is this movie going to make two? Is it, can it make it? Yeah. And it did. But again, you, this is the perception you have. You, when you go to a movie and you, you know, like if you take another film, that another film was the Bruce Willis film, Hudson Hawk. That was the Michael Lehman film, which is again about a cat, like a jewel thief who goes into things, and he does it to music, a bit like Baby Driver. He goes in there and he's doing like, he's going after it, but it had like, I'm trying to remember who played the, you know, there was, you know,
I've seen it, yes.
But
I was hoping for worse. I remember watching that and being disappointed it wasn't worse, because I was like, this, it was such a notorious
film. But it was actually, was actually a better film that I saw it at the Holloway Odeon, and, you know, again, and somebody had actually seen it as a preview and said, Austin Hawks actually, right?
Yeah, I was expecting. Yeah, you know, that's the thing, I was disappointed because I was expecting it to be terrible,
right.
And it was like, it was all right. It was okay. It's fine.
You know,
it's
we kind of got through it. You know, it's you know, but again, I mean, another film that kind of comes linking to that was Michael Lehman's Heathers, which is you know, that was a cult film, which talked about teen suicide, but was subverting the whole kind of high school thing. But it's got one of my favorite lines where Kim Walker says, "Fuck me gently with a chainsaw."
Jesus Christ.
And he goes, well, and the other one is, where he talks about Martha Dunstock, and she goes, "Come on, it will be very, the nut will give a shower nozzle masturbation material for weeks."
I think Heathers, was it?
Yeah.
Oh, blimey.
But it's, again, it's a movie, it's a dark comedy because Christian Slater, who plays, the James Dean character, I mean, he's totally whacked out and he's actually determined to blow up the school.
Yeah, he's going to murder.
I can't know.
But Winona Ryder's absolutely fantastic. Yeah. And I mean,
what's happened to her?
She's done Stranger Things. I mean, I think she's hooked up with a art dealer in San Francisco because after her shoplifting thing.
That's all I can remember about her. Yeah.
But you know, she found her way back. She played, Spock's mother in Star Trek. She's found her new audience again because she plays the mother in Stranger Things.
I was going to say, she's turned up as the mum.
Right, the mum, yeah.
She's aged into being. Yeah.
And she's also in the upcoming Beetlejuice 2 sequel.
No.
Fantastic. Okay, that's cool.
It's not a remake.
No, it's a sequel.
Oh, sequel.
Which, again, going back to what you were talking about earlier, that was one of the films that's been affected by the strike.
Oh, is Michael back in it?
Michael Keaton's back. All the principal characters are back, but they were doing like a wedding scene in, you know, she's playing the older version now. Right, Ryder. But they were shooting it up at, I think they were shooting it up at Leavesden or somewhere.
That would do Tim well, wouldn't it?
Tim Burton attached.
Oh, right, yeah.
I think so. Yeah. I think he's back in there. You'll probably have to look it up. I know from what I gather, it's all the.
Oh, okay.
I don't know whether Alec Baldwin and Gina Davis are still attached to it.
Alec Baldwin.
But he's, but again, I mean, but hopefully, you know, he's.
Yeah.
But I mean, after what he's been through.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a weird one, isn't it? Anyway.
His film came out, didn't it? The one that where he shot the guy.
Russ, they are finishing.
Was it a Netflix? Where did I see it?
I think they're finishing shooting it.
The one where he shot the guy on
Portraits of Work.
Shot that? No, he shot the, you know, there was the manslaughter thing because Elena Hutchins, who was the cinematographer, was accidentally shot on the set. I actually did an interview with a lady called Olia Operina, who actually worked with her on a short film called I Am Normal. And I actually asked her about, you know, what was so special about it. Cause this short film is a bit like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Yeah.
And she had such a talent for period cinematography. So, but they haven't really been focusing on that. Everybody seems to have forgotten about Helena Hutchins. They haven't really, everybody's talking about Alec Baldwin. Yeah. She's a shame, but you know, it was quite a poignant interview when I chatted to her.
Well, I can see that Beetlejuice film doing well, like the humor for it, dark humor sort of thing.
But again, that's another film that again you could class as a, you know, like Gremlins or stuff like that, because they had Gremlins on TV last night, and again, it's that was, they're both the Gremlins and Gremlins 2.
Oh.
And again, that's a film that again crosses, you know, it's because again it was given a restricted rating in 1984 because they were, you know, like the with the cuddly toys. So, you know, Gizmo was kind of, you know, was cute.
Yeah.
But it was an adult film, you know, the thing in the blender, you know, the Grim.
Yeah, do you think about
the,
it?
And
yeah.
the bit where she goes up in the loft, and, yeah. you know.
You know, with the chair, the yeah. electric chair.
It's, yeah. You're like,
and, you know, like Ghostbusters, for example, like, you know, when you look at that, that is, you know, I mean, if that failed, I mean, we might have been talking about that as a cult film. You know, it's like.
I think it's a wonder. Some things get picked up, and well, some things find an audience, some things become very successful and hit that zeitgeist, and some things don't, and it seems to be very hit and miss. Some things that are very good, you know, very well crafted and have all the ingredients to be successful, don't connect at that time, and there's some things that are garbage.
Yeah. But there are, but the thing about it is I saw another film recently. I saw a film called The Apple with Catherine Mary Stewart.
Oh yes.
And I interviewed her about it, and she said that actually it's a very popular film at the Lincoln Center. So we were chatting briefly about it, and she said, look, and I asked her, said, well, what is it about this movie that, you know, why do people gravitate towards it now that they didn't do at the time? Cause it's, I mean, I went to see it at the Prince Charles Cinema with friends. I had front row seats with my friend Jenny and Jonathan. We were sitting there and we just kind of looked. And the thing is, it's got such catchy tracks. But when you watch it, it's like, so what it is it's like Catherine Mary Stewart plays a singer called BB. And when you watch it, you'll actually feel like you're watching The X Factor or The Big Reunion. And there's and like the record executive looks like Ming the Merciless. And there's a song called I'm Coming. And it's actually like a bunch of people on a bed with orgies and stuff like that.
Yes. Yes.
But the crazy thing is I actually said, I thought these songs are actually quite catchy. Yeah. You know, you know, I'm sure there are other examples, you know, and I probably could talk to you, you know, about other films in the mix anyway, which, you know, and there'll be other titles that I can think of that will, you know, get there. There's horror titles called The Wraith and The Gates, for example, from 1987. The Gate is about there's a gateway in the garden. The Wraith is Charlie Sheen, who plays like a dead driver who comes back and he's a Mercedes and he kills everybody on the road.
Okay, killer car movie.
I would also, other titles include The Hitcher, the 1986 film with Rutger Hauer C. Thomas Howell, which again is a road movie. I mean, Rutger Hauer is absolutely terrifying as John Ryder. But again, you know, it's a movie that's, has such interesting, you know, it's a road movie, and, you know, there's that scene where C. Thomas Howell is eating the fries and then he suddenly picks up a bloody finger in the bloody fries.
Well, that's the cult movies. Yeah. So, well, next time I see you, we're going to do the Halloween, my favorite time of the year. We're going to come up with some ideas for that. Lovely.
I think there's, I'll have to think about that because we've done the Halloween.
Yeah.
I did my horror titles, but I'm trying to sort of this debate.
I reckon there's, I've seen a couple of good black and white horrors, you know, like 50s, that you have to switch your brain off a little bit. But you go, that's
well, we could, bad. I mean, perhaps we could talk about like the origins of horror, the whole kind of, when we look at things like Dracula and Frankenstein and some of the 50s. I mean, I'm into movies like, I love, you know, 50s sci-fi like Them, you know, like, you know, giant ants and stuff. And, you know, there's other films that we could include, but I think I did sort of talk about, but let me think about it.
Yeah, we'll come up with some ideas.
Fair conversation. Yeah.
Have you got our Halloween, decorations still?
Oh yeah. Yeah. Ready.
All £3 worth.
Every year. Yeah. I break them out. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah. Bring them with you next time we speak to John. All right. Excuse us for the state of us, but the heat, we've had to open the window a little bit as well. So excuse the sound. We'll see you at the end of, when is it, October?
Yeah.
Okay, lovely. Thank you very much, John. Thank you.
Step by step, you're on your way. You're welcome to You could be larger than